a number of us have heard about in the last year, especially in kind of some emerging issues that I think this committee really needs to know more about as we go forward and enter into the session. So there won't be any business transacted today, but simply we're here to hear about these two particular issues. And the first of those deals with the level of assessment that properties throughout the state have when there are easements purchased on them. And I think we'll just have Mr. Klayman from House Research kind of lead us into that topic and kind of give us a background that he's prepared with today. Thank you, Mr. Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Chris Klayman. I'm with House Research. And I'm just going to provide a fairly general, more high-level overview of the Bland and Paper Company decision that was decided last year. And I'll also go through a few of the recent statutory changes that in part could mitigate some of the impact of Blandon, although there are some questions that may remain about how broadly the potential precedent to come out of Blandon may apply going forward. And there are a few handouts too that I saw over there, a more detailed memo that gets into some more of the details of the case, and then a short more bullet point summary of the case. So if there are details that you have questions of, feel free to consult those resources as well. So to start out, the Blandon decision was a decision by the Minnesota Tax Court. It was decided last summer. And the case involved an appeal that Blandon Paper Company made on their 2010 and 2011 assessments on a very large number of parcels in four counties up north, totaling, as you can see, around 170,000 acres. The result of the decision was that the market value that the parcels had initially been assessed at went down significantly. And as you can see for the 2011 assessment, the market value went down from $190 million to $25 million, which represented a significant erosion of the tax base on those parcels. The main issue in Blandon essentially concerned the application of what was called the unit rule in the case. And the unit rule is the idea that in certain circumstances it may make sense to group multiple parcels together as a single unit. The effect of that typically would be that the market for those parcels narrows and the market value therefore goes down. And the tax court held that in fact for the 2010 and 2011 assessments at issue in Blandon that the unit rule should be applied.
Mr. Klayman, can you say that again about how the unit rule works?
Sure. And I do have a few slides later on in the presentation that get into that in some detail. But in general, the basic idea behind the unit rule is that in certain circumstances, multiple parcels that are multiple individual parcels could be grouped together as a single unit for valuation purposes. And typically when that happens, you'll see a narrowing of the market for those parcels as essentially the property size gets bigger. There'll be fewer buyers for those parcels, and that'll have the market impact of reducing the value of those parcels. And in this instance, I'll get into it a little bit later too, but in this instance, the total value of the parcel as a single unit was then allocated through a scheme that the tax court put forward, allocated between the 78 different taxing jurisdictions.
Thank you.
I think the anchor of the tax court's decision has to do with the idea that the market value of a property really has to reflect the reality of the market for those properties. And that involves determining who the buyers are in that market and what price would they actually pay for the property at issue. And I put a quote here from the tax court on that point. Continuing this line of thought on market value, again, what's driving this idea is that the parcels cannot be valued as if they existed in a market that's different than the one in which they actually exist, according to the tax court. So the sales comps that you would use to determine what the value of those parcels are have to be based on an accurate understanding of what the market is. And there's some, I guess I would characterize it as somewhat strong language that the tax court uses with regard to the county's argument about how that would end up affecting the value of the parcels, in the sense that the county's argument would use prices drawn from the wrong market for the wrong subject property for a use other than the property's highest and best use, which would violate, according to the tax court, longstanding valuation principles. So the tax court then moved on to the highest and best use analysis, which is part of the market analysis. The idea behind highest and best use is that assessors should try and find the most probable use at the highest price, the highest value. Probable use, I think, is the key phrase to sort of key into on this, because if certain uses are not probable or possible, then those uses can't be used to determine what the market value of those parcels are. And in this instance, the tax court said that due to the land use restrictions that existed on the Blandin's parcels from Sustainable Forest Incentive Act enrollment and from the conservation easement, that the uses were limited such that only a few permissible uses remained. And so, for instance, SFIA enrollment, which entails certain land use restrictions, prohibited residential sales, recreational leasing, and imposed a four-year waiting period for withdrawal. The recreational leasing issue is kind of interesting because the SFIA enrollment required that whoever owned the property has to provide access to the public to use for certain recreational purposes. And then I guess I call your attention to the under the second sub-bullet, after the second bullet, the conservation easement, which prohibited, for the most part, all uses except timber production. That last phrase, parcels could not be subdivided, I think that's a key fact that the tax court took note of, that the conservation easement, while it allowed a sale of the parcels, it did not allow any of the parcels to be divided, so that it couldn't be sold under the conservation easement on a parcel-by-parcel basis. It had to be sold in its entirety. And so, again, the tax court will determine that, or did determine that, the market value for those properties had to reflect that reality. So in short, as the tax court concluded its highest and best use analysis, they held that the highest and best use of the property was for timber production as of both assessment dates for 2010 and 2011. Although the income from timber production could have been supplemented in 2010 from a few other sources, nonetheless, the highest and best use was timber production. There's another interesting maybe comment I'll make about this quote from the tax court. The second and third line references the idea that income could have been supplemented by the sale of a conservation easement, but it does not appear that possibility made it into the court's final reconciliation of value for those parcels. And there was a post-trial motion on the issue where the counties argued that they should be able to provide evidence that the potential sale of the easement should affect the market value for 2010, and essentially the tax court held that they could have argued that at trial, and they just missed their chance. I'm not sure if that's part of the appeal right now to the Minnesota Supreme Court, but I should also mention, too, that in the highest and best use analysis, the court concluded that the parcels would be sold as a single unit, and that further, the most probable purchasers for the parcels would be large institutional investors, like a timber investment management organization or a timber right. And so here you see the idea that the land use restrictions, by restricting a variety of uses of the parcels, ended up narrowing the market to just a handful of very large institutional investors who would, again, purchase it as a single unit. So having concluded its highest and best use analysis and its market analysis, the court addressed a more theoretical legal issue in the case regarding whether the unit rule was an appropriate valuation methodology or a lawful valuation methodology under Minnesota law. And the counties argued that, pointing to a number of specific provisions under Minnesota law, that the unit rule was per se unlawful. And the idea was that it was per se unlawful because, based on the statutes, Minnesota law contemplated a parcel-by-parcel approach to assessment. However, the tax court distinguished between some of the provisions that the counties pointed to and the valuation provisions under Minnesota law, and said that the provisions that the counties were referring to were administrative in nature, and that the provision that should control the analysis in Blandon with respect to the unit rule was the valuation provision under Minnesota law. And simply put, that provision simply states that all property shall be valued at its market value. So once again, going back to this, what seems to be the anchoring principle of the tax court's decision in Blandon, the idea that an accurate and realistic market value has to be the goal of an assessment under Minnesota law. So in applying the unit rule, in this instance, the tax court held that, again repeating the theme, that the Blandon parcels cannot be valued in a way that's contrary to their highest and best use. In other words, you have to value them according to market realities. The court then goes on to describe some of the case law in Minnesota and from other jurisdictions that support the use of the unit rule as an accepted valuation methodology, and concludes that applying the unit rule in Minnesota would not violate past precedent or violate any statutes. So I think the big question to come out of Blandon, if the decision is going to be upheld at the Supreme Court level, and if the decision is going to stand, and if the unit rule comes to be an accepted valuation methodology, I think the big issue to come out of this is how and when should the unit rule be applied. I don't think there's any specific guidance that the tax court gives in terms of a one or a two or a three-step test, but I think there are some general principles that you can glean from the case to guide the analysis of when the unit rule may be appropriate to apply in certain instances. I think initially you need a common ownership of the parcels and a common pattern of use. But I think you also have to show that the market has been narrowed for those parcels such that you really don't have a lot of buyers in that market who could purchase those parcels for other uses than a few permitted uses. This goes back to the idea that, you know, a narrow market means that smaller buyers have been sort of knocked out of the market because they can't purchase the parcels for use that a smaller buyer would purchase them for. And in terms of how you show the narrow market and how you knock those buyers out of the market, you probably need to show that there are some land use restrictions on the land that prevent certain uses, such that the market becomes narrowed. I don't think it's required under Blandon that you'd have to have a land use restriction, but as a practical matter, I think you would need to show some land use restrictions to be able to apply the unit rule and make the required showing about the market. And in terms of a sort of a big picture concept to sort of anchor your thinking on when to apply the unit rule, when the tax court discussed case law from other jurisdictions regarding the unit rule, they used the phrase economic reality twice when discussing those cases, and I think that provides a good sort of concept or a good target to aim at if you're thinking about when to apply the unit rule. That the idea is that the unit rule, you're going to have to show that the economic reality of the parcels is such that the unit rule would make sense to apply. So it's almost like a sort of a common sense test in a way that you need to make sure that in the end the market reality surrounding the parcel and the realities of the parcel's use support the application of the unit rule. So I don't think this is coming out of Blandon, and I don't think this is just a technical, if you meet this step of a test and you meet that step of a test, you'll get the unit rule. I think you still have to make a showing about the economic reality. That's not necessarily a test that the tax court lays down, but I think that's maybe an interesting way to think of it. Moving on to the last part of the case, the tax court noted two state actions that at the time of the assessments in 2010 and 2011 significantly affected the market value for those parcels. The first one was the cap on Sustainable Forest Incentive Act payments, and the second one was the state's purchase of the conservation easement. And for 187,000 acres, you can imagine that limiting the SFIA payment to $100,000 would represents a significant difference from what SFIA payments would be on that property without the cap. And it's currently at $7 an acre, so that's a difference of between $100,000 and about $1.31 million. So significant cash flow difference. And of course, the purchase of the conservation easement imposed the use restrictions and the prohibition on subdividing the properties at sale, which had an impact on the market. However, back in 2013, as the appeals process was working its way through the system, the legislature changed the law governing how land subject to a conservation easement should be assessed, and went from a statute that allowed adjustments, essentially allowed reductions in value if a property was subject to a conservation easement, to prohibiting reductions of value for a property that was subject to a conservation easement. And in 2014, this was clarified that the amended law that prohibited reductions on the value of property subject to a conservation easement would only apply to new easements. These are easements that were entered into on May 23rd, 2013 or later. So it creates almost a bifurcated system where you have old easements and new easements, and the old easements are, although technically the law is silent, they presumably can still be reduced in market value due to the existence of an easement, conservation easement, whereas new easements, you cannot have the reduction on those parcels. And again, in 2013, the legislature lifted the cap on SFIA payments. And again, this goes, so for 187,000 acres, you go from $100,000 to $1.3 million. Presumably the higher cash flow would affect the market value of a large number of acres enrolled in SFIA as a result. So in short, the state of the law as it stands now is that we have old easements that can be reduced and new easements that must not be reduced. And SFIA land is now, again, more valuable in most cases because the cap on SFIA payments has been lifted. That being said, I think there are probably some lingering questions out of this case that may be clarified once the Supreme Court makes its decision about just how broadly the unit rule could end up being interpreted and applied in a variety of assessment scenarios going forward. If it has a narrow application, then the impact on the tax base in a number of jurisdictions might be small. If it's broadly applied, obviously it could have a much larger impact. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have as far as the presentation goes. Of course, I'm happy to answer questions if anybody does.
Thank you, Mr. Kleeman. A question from Representative Quam and then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from this, it brings up the question of, you know, a governmental entity, be it local, state or agency or federal, adds restrictions, say environmental or whatever restrictions that make it practically or economically infeasible to utilize for, say, ferrous metal mining, for industrial silica sand, etc. I could see this impacting the tax base, you know, for some areas that have, you know, 60, 80, 85% of the property not in the hands of a private but a governmental entity, that any kind of impact, you know, and this is a non-trivial impact in this case, which could also be non-trivial for, you know, some of those resource valuations. Do you have any idea of the magnitude a broad interpretation would have?
Mr. Kleeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I don't have any, and I haven't seen any research into the exact numbers that we're looking at, if there's a broad application. I think in part because I think the first issue that really would need to be settled is exactly in what instances would the unit rule be applied. But certainly if it was applied broadly and you had, you know, a lot of situations, or you had a lot of, you know, land that was subject to a variety of land use restrictions that prevented it from being used for certain purposes, I mean, that certainly would reduce the value of those parcels. I don't know the extent of, in the scenario you described, I don't know the extent of, you know, the acreage and the kind of valuations we're looking at for that, but it's, I mean, it is something I could take a look at, and if I find anything concrete, I can certainly provide the committee with that information.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sir, listening to your testimony and some of your key phrases and statements, and trying to maybe expand that to other types of property, so I'm going to ask a couple of general questions. In this Blandon case, you mentioned the highest and best use of the land being timber. Does that take into account things like production potential, market conditions, and income potential?
Mr. Kleeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, it should. The tax court did reference the aspect of the Blandon appraisal where a discussion of current timber prices plays into the valuation of these parcels. So, at least indirectly, those considerations would play into how those properties are assessed and how they'd be appraised.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Again, I guess what I'm getting at, too, is agricultural land prices have reached high levels, and now the income potential has dropped significantly. Will that or should that play a part in the assessment of those lands?
Mr. Kleeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, to the extent that the for instance, grain prices might affect the amount of income that could be earned off a piece of ag land. To the extent that that affects market value, that should have an impact on the market value that's determined by, at least in the context of this decision, that should have an impact on the market value for the parcels as assessed. Although in terms of assessments for agricultural land, I'd have to research that a little bit further to get you a more specific answer. But
Representative Anderson.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last comment. You talked about the economic reality. The assessment should reflect actual value and reality. I've heard a couple of cases, and not necessarily farmland, maybe some commercial property where there's been some difficulty. And there's been a sale, and it's what's called a distressed sale. And that, as I understand, cannot be used for assessment. But doesn't that really, in effect, indicate what reality is? And what's your thought on using those types of sales for assessment?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, again, if you're just sort of keying in on the language of market value here, I think the idea behind the distressed sale idea that you're bringing up is that a distressed sale may not necessarily accurately reflect what the market conditions are for a parcel that's subject to a distressed sale. Although I could see the argument, of course, that if you have a lot of distressed sales of certain types of property, then that would indicate that maybe there's an economic reality there where maybe the market for those parcels actually is, at some point, going to narrow or it's going to decline. But I think in terms of how that would play out in an assessment or a challenge to an assessment, I think you have to, you'd really have to produce evidence that the market is or is not a certain way. So it ends up becoming, to some extent, really just a factual determination. What sales are we going to use and what's the basis for determining those sales? But in terms of tax court precedent on distressed sales, again, I'd have to research the issue. But
thank you, Mr. Klayman. So with that, too, you wouldn't have that test of whether it would require an institutional landowner. I mean, that would be different as well, right? I mean, than this, in contrast. Just Mr. Klayman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess this brings up the issue of how the unit rule would be applied. Do you necessarily need to have a market that's only comprised of large institutional investors to apply the unit rule? Is that the
yes?
Yeah. So I think theoretically you don't necessarily need to have large institutional investors. You just need to show that there's a very narrow market for the group of parcels together, and such that the only purchasers who would buy them would buy them as a single unit.
Thank you. Other questions, members, for Mr. Klayman? Quickly, Mr. Klayman, so what we have is we've got this unit rule, tax court judgment or opinion in front of us, and then we have that 2013 law, 13 and 14 law. Are they in direct conflict then? Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, I don't think they're in direct conflict. I think that the statutory change to how conservation easements affect the value of properties subject to a conservation easement, I think it just creates maybe a slightly more complicated analysis where, I mean, one way to look at it is to say that, new easements would be ignored. So if you had a similar case to Blandon, under similar facts, but that involved a new easement, so a May 23rd, 2013 or later easement, that presumably that easement would be ignored when that property is being assessed for tax purposes. And whereas an old easement would continue to be subject to, the Blandon treatment, essentially. But I, I don't think that there's necessarily a conflict between the decision and the law. It just creates a slightly more complicated analysis when assessments of that nature are done.
And members, our property tax system gets more complicated. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. Thank you so much. Next on the agenda, actually, Mr. May from the Association of Assessors. Mr. Klayman, Representative Quam has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. With those two differences on easements, the same exact type of property in the same jurisdiction, would it not have two different actual values in the market? Because if I'm purchasing property and I can pick between two, one, the easement and its future implications has an impact. The other, that easement would have the same future implications, but there would be no route to the effect on the property tax. There's a obvious choice that I would make. I'd pick the one that if something happened by the government in the future that devalued the property, I'd have a recourse. The other I didn't. And you're saying statute, the assessors, etc., wouldn't be able to say there's a different value for assessment between those two properties?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, a parcel subject to a new easement, you wouldn't necessarily get, quote unquote, a tax break on that parcel. So the property would, although the valuations may be different between the two parcels, you'd have this, one of them has essentially the lower tax and the other would have the higher tax. As far as, I think maybe what you're driving at is the idea that, two similarly situated parcels that have a similar conservation easement on them, one of them is going to have a high value and one's going to have a low value. If you have one easement that's old and one easement that's new, maybe creates some implications for the market value of those properties or impacts, the decisions that people would make in terms of purchasing and selling those properties. I think that's right. I think that may create some of those what look like inconsistencies going forward. But of course, potential purchasers in the market for properties would understand presumably the ins and outs of that. So I hope that gets at what you're.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to remember that there's really two arguments going on here, and that is market forces and then market forces that are impacted by easements. And with regard to the notion that the market becomes limited in a certain size of parcel, is the market. That's the reality. And so we have a bifurcated system right now as a result of the statute change. But think about the impacts that it means. If a farmer wants to sell his farm, he's offering it for sale only as the whole thing, for example. And in that circumstance, it's going to have a lesser value because it limits the market in terms of who has the capacity to purchase the property. So there's three ways that property is generally valued, whether it's the market approach, the income approach, or the cost approach. Cost approach usually implies improved property. So in this case, and in a farm, for example, which is used for production, that's not improved property either. So then you're down to market and income approach. So there's a couple different ways to determine value. But if the movement here is to appeal the ruling, and I think the ruling so far from what I've heard of this argument, is a proper ruling. And it would have the potential of saying to a farmer, well, even though it's a whole section of land that you're putting in corn production, and because you've been recently annexed by a municipality that's growing, you have development potential that makes it more valuable than it is to grow corn. And a farmer's argument would always be the land is only worth what it can produce. And so we do have parts of our tax system that provides, in that circumstance, production relief, you know, through green acres or protecting it from that very same thing. But this is kind of an argument in a rural area where you kind of want to have your cake and eat it too. Well, it's worth more money as recreational property and has more value because it could be parsed out into a bunch of little parcels. But in this case, and the court's decision as such, the easements prohibit the subdivision of it, keeps it intact, and for those who've gone on the forestry tours as part of some of our legislative experience, I mean, in Minnesota, the large tracts of land for highest and best use, in this case, timber production, are becoming fewer because we gave up that $7 an acre thing, I believe, 2 years ago. So it's not just simply the easement aspect of it. I mean, the market is the market. And if it's a large parcel, inherently the market means there's going to be less buyers. The higher the value of property, the less buyers there are. It's just the reality, and that's the market approach.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. I think one of the questions in terms of policy as we go forward here, maybe you want to comment quickly, Mr. Klayman, and then we need to get to the next presenter, but as we have more and more easements purchased, and does this have the potential to increase or augment or bring more emphasis to the easement market, if you will? Will there be more people in pursuit of easements, of selling easements to the state of Minnesota for legacy and other forms of money that comes from the taxpayers so that they can turn around and demonstrate reduced value and then reduce their taxes, property taxes, which will then be shifted, of course, to their neighbors? Your thoughts on that, Mr. Lane?
Mr. Chair, I think there's maybe two separate issues there. The first is that I think that the 2013 change in law, concerns have been expressed that actually drives up the cost of conservation easements to the state because now the price has to reflect the fact that for new easements, the a property owner is no longer going to get the tax break due to having the value reduced to the existence of the conservation easement. But for new easements going forward, they should be ignored for assessment purposes. So I think a seller of a conservation easement would understand that the value of the property for assessment purposes, even while as a practical matter it can't be used for a lot of other purposes, that the value of the land for assessment purposes is not going to see a reduction.
So, Mr. Klayman, but what about, will a unit rule then, does a unit rule, and did the court only apply it to that before 2013 situation, or are they suggesting you can apply it in the future if you have these scattered parcels that are suddenly looked at as one unit subject to or only marketable to an institutional investor?
Mr. Chair, to clarify, for old easements can continue to be valued according to, let me back up. The unit rule can be applied so far as this decision is concerned. The unit rule can be applied with or without regard to whether there's a conservation easement on a property, potentially. The question, of course, is when you apply it. For old easements, so easements that were entered into prior to May 23rd, 2013, those easements can continue to be taken into account when it comes to determining the market value of those parcels. And because now the law is silent on what to do with those parcels, what to do with those the property subject to those easements, the market value of a large group of parcels subject to an old conservation easement can continue to be reduced in value. And that's not going to change. But for unless, of course, there's a change in statute. But for easements entered into on May 23rd, 2013 and after, those easements would have to be ignored for valuation purposes. So how that would play into the unit rule is kind of an interesting speculative question, which is that if you ignore a conservation easement for a group of parcels like the Blandon parcels, can you still get the unit rule application? Or is there something fundamental about the conservation easement that would trigger the application of the unit rule? And I think you could probably still get the application of the unit rule without a conservation easement, but it's not entirely clear. It would be more a case-by-case basis. But so again, the bifurcation of the system is that for old easements, they can continue to be taken into account for valuation purposes and potentially grouped together in the unit rule going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Klayman. Representative Hertaus, did you have a question?
Well, just a quick one.
Representative Hertaus, quickly.
Yes, thank you. But what you're talking about, to be clear, with regard to easements and even with regard to the new rule, is you're talking about the assembly of multiple parcels to apply the unit rule as opposed to an individual parcel that may have an easement.
Mr. Klayman.
That's correct, Representative Hertaus. There would be two separate issues there. So one is, when do we apply the unit rule, and the other is, to what extent would an individual parcel's value be reduced due to the existence of a conservation easement? And the 2013 change in law says for new easements, you basically ignore the conservation easement when determining the value of that individual parcel.
Thank you, Mr. Klayman, Representative Hertaus. Thank you so much for outlining that today and getting into this, what is a very complex issue. Mr. May from the Assessors Association. Welcome, Mr. May. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, or MAAO, as we call it. Every year we prepare a position statement for our legislative process, and I hope you have a copy. If you don't, I hope you have one very soon. But our number two point in there is MAO's real support of market value, that we support in all concepts of property tax, that we establish market value of properties. In that regard, I'm not here today to talk about the Blandon case. As has been mentioned, that case will be heard in the Supreme Court in April, and MAO did participate in the amicus brief that was prepared for that Supreme Court hearing and our opposition to the unit rule. What I'd like to talk about briefly is 273.117, which is a statute that guides how assessors look at conservation easements. If you go back far enough in time, the statute originally said that in the issue of a conservation easement, the assessor shall adjust. As assessors, we felt that language was far too restrictive because in the area of conservation easements, there's no two that are identical. They're all different, and depending on the property that's placed under the conservation easement, the impact on valuation is different. We worked with many people in the legislature to get that change to May, which gave the assessor the ability to look at each individual conservation easement and determine whether there's an impact on market value. I'll give you two quick examples of how that can be different. If you have a 40-acre parcel in the metropolitan area that the assessor has valued highest and best use as being development, the value could easily, and I'll just throw a number out, could be $150,000 an acre. For that development. If that's placed under a conservation easement and they take away the ability to develop that property in the easement but still allow recreational use, the assessor would make an adjustment to what the recreational use of that property would be. If you take a similar, not similar, the 40-acre parcel in northern Minnesota that's the assessor has valued for timber production, and that's the highest and best use of that property in the assessor's estimation. If a conservation easement is placed on that property that takes away the development rights but still allows timber production, there really hasn't been an impact on the value of that property because the highest and best use that the assessor has used is timber, and that use is still available under the conservation easement as far as maybe hunting and some other things. So every easement has to be looked at differently. So we certainly, as an assessor's organization, support 273.117 the way it was written that allows the assessor the ability and the flexibility to look at these easements, analyze them, and make a market determination based on the facts. So we would certainly support that the may adjust would be the statute and the shall not. The shall not really results in something other than market value on these properties that may or may not now come under conservation easement. With that, I would be open for any questions you might have.
Questions, members, for Mr. May? Okay, thank you, Ms. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. May, I'm looking at 273.117, and you just said may, but it says shall not be reduced. That's, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Member Erickson, up until 2013, the language said may adjust and gave the assessor the flexibility to make those adjustments.
Got it.
After 2013, yes. The shall not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Other questions for Mr. May? Thank you, sir. Next, we have Mr. Cipolla from the St. Louis County Tax Assessor. Welcome, Mr. Cipolla. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Cipolla. I'm the county assessor for St. Louis County. I was asked to come here today to talk a little bit about the Blandon easement. And as has been noted, this is still in litigation. The Supreme Court is going to be speaking about this in June, I believe. So I can speak mostly about the easement itself, but not necessarily about the case that's going on. I did prepare a little overview, and I'd like to thank Mr. Klayman for doing a good overview, which basically covers most of what I was going to talk about. I'd like to talk a little bit about the easement itself. It was purchased by the state of Minnesota in July of 2010. For a purchase price of $43,700,000, and it affects four counties: Itasca, St. Louis, Aiken, and Coochiching. It affects over 187,000 acres in those four counties, primarily in Itasca. Itasca has over 83% of the Blandon property that's encumbered by the easement. My colleague Amber Peritallo from Itasca was planning to be here today but wasn't able to do so. St. Louis County has approximately 12% of the Blandon easement. The easement is broken up into individual parcels that range from a half acre to over 600 acres. So there's a wide variety of those. They cover 78 different taxing districts in the four counties. The easement itself prohibits certain uses such as residential, commercial, industrial, agricultural. It does permit forest management activities. Blandon retained the right to do logging, retained wetland credits, carbon credits, and SFAIA payments. And as noted, the easement also provides that the property has to remain in a unified ownership and cannot be divided. Blandon did file a tax court petition in April of 11 and also on in 12. Those are the years that were decided by the tax court. There are there are additional petitions for 13, 14, and 15 as well. I believe we are waiting for the Supreme Court decision before those are pursued. The tax court did reduce the value of the property for the 2 years under petition The first year, pay 11, it was reduced by approximately 73%. The second year was 86%. So it did make a large difference in the valuations. I've also been asked to talk a little bit about the types of easements themselves. Mr. May discussed this briefly. There are different types of easements, particularly in the north part of the county or north part of the state. The easements that we typically see in St. Louis County affect lake frontage. We have quite a few of those. Those are primarily protecting undeveloped lakeshore. This was the first easement that I had seen that was not lakeshore related. It was also the first easement that I had seen that was actually purchased. All of the other ones are voluntarily entered into by the property owners. One of the other issues that is of a concern to the commissioners, administrators, and the counties that are involved is that the values that are reduced for these conservation easements, we're looking at the ownership of the property, in particular the Blandin case. This property is still owned by Blandin. Their interest, the value of their interest, is reduced because of the existence of the easement. However, the state does own part of that property. They own a portion of the bundle of rights. They have an easement interest in it. Their interest in the property is essentially unaccounted for at this point. Blandin's value is of their remaining interest, but the interest that the state purchased is not accounted for anywhere in the assessment. So that is one of the concerns that the counties have. I believe the rest of my presentation has already been covered, so if anyone has questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Cipolla. So that portion of the rights that the state has purchased could be analogous to the state buying property outright and for, you know, as we do 10,000 acres a year or so here in St. Paul. So it's just kind of maybe a smaller portion. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, and your county is affected to a degree, but do you have any idea or numbers as to how much of a shift this could result to those in Itasca County?
Mr. Cipolla.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm really not familiar with Itasca County, although I know that they have some townships there that are dramatically affected by this easement and the decision of the tax court. I don't know if I'm comfortable speaking for Amber for that, but I do know it is significant for several of their smaller townships that are primarily Blandin ownership.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Cipolla? Thank you, Mr. Cipolla. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Weir or Ware? Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Weir, Liz Weir, and until 2015 I was the mayor of Medina. However, I'm here today as a private citizen. I'm not representing the city. Having served as a mayor, I'm very aware of the significance and necessity for tax dollars. And being in office, I learned the art of compromise. I seek to amend Minnesota statute, the change to the statute, 273.117. My focus is the 11-county metropolitan area rather than statewide. During my time in office, Medina lost large stands of high-quality big woods to dense sewer development. Natural resources such as irreplaceable native woodlands have particular value. They contribute to clean air and water. They provide open space and natural beauty for residents, and they increase surrounding property values. It's a quality of life issue. I understand that Senate Tax Chair Rod Skoe, who sponsored the 2013 change to the statute, was concerned about tax income in northern Minnesota, where thousands of acres are off the books for tax purposes. In comparison, the 11-county metro area is tax-rich. My hope is the Congressional Tax Committee might consider an exception to Minnesota Statute 273.117 within the 11-county metropolitan area that would restore reduced valuation of land that is put into permanent conservation with the development rights removed. Can I answer any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Weir. Questions for Ms. Weir. Representative Hertas.
Just a comment. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Weir, former mayor in my district. I just wanted to clarify the properties that you referenced in northern Minnesota are not off the books.
Oh.
They're still taxpayers.
I'm naive.
Ms. Weir.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you so much, Ms. Weir. So, members, without any other questions or presenters, we will move into our and thank you all presenters. Anyone else that would like to speak on this topic? Going once, twice, three times. We will move on to the franchise fees discussion, and Ms. Dalton will lead the charge on helping us understand franchise fees and the structure of them and how they work in the state. Welcome, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I'm going to be giving the 20,000-foot overview on city franchise fees, and I do mean 20,000 feet. This is not an area that the legislature has visited very much. As a matter of fact, the statute for the franchise fees on natural gas and electric utilities hasn't been amended since 1991. So this is not something that we deal with on a regular basis. So I just want to say that up front. So, quick background. The authority to impose fees on electric and natural gas utilities was enacted in 1974. As I said, it hasn't been amended since 1991. It was part of a larger bill imposing state regulation on public utilities. This does not mean that there were no franchise fees imposed on public utilities prior to that. It just means that the state didn't provide the authority. It was often done through home rule charter. Franchise fees on cable companies were allowed under a 1973 law, and it is a separate law. The bill that's going to be before this committee is actually only going to be addressing franchise fees on electric and natural gas utilities. But there is a separate set of statutes that relates to cables. As I said, that was enacted in 1993. The cable franchise fees are also impacted by the Federal Cable Communications Policy Act of 1984, and that one actually put a limit on how much can be imposed in cable franchise fees of 5% of gross receipts. Having said the limit on cable franchise fees, there's no limit on fees imposed on electric and natural gas utilities. That is a totally local decision. Not only is the fee amount a local decision, but how the fee is imposed is a local decision. It can be imposed on a hookup basis, on a percentage of receipts basis, or it can be based on the units actually consumed. And this will have an impact on how stable franchise fees are in individual districts. And the other thing that's important to note is that franchise fees are not dedicated revenues unless a local government chooses to dedicate them themselves. They can use them for whatever purpose that they want. I'm going to make a few other points that are not on the slide that have come up as I've been working on this. There are different people who can impose franchise fees. The franchise fees on electric and gas utilities can only be imposed by cities. However, cable Franchise fees can be imposed by cities, towns, counties, or any combination thereof. One of the things I found out actually just this morning is that there are seven cable commissions that are listed as special taxing districts, and they have an additional $10 million of what we believe are franchise fees that are not going to show up in the slides here. So just so you know that, and that's because counties or some combination can actually impose the franchise fee. So that's why we have these seven special districts. So just kind of a brief history. 1975, 23 cities imposed franchise fees. In 2014, the most recent year, there's 357 cities imposing franchise fees. Now, before we go much further, I need to say that all of this data comes from the state auditor's report. Unfortunately, the state auditor does not differentiate where the franchise fees are being imposed. So I can't tell you how much is being collected on cable franchise fees versus electric franchise fees versus gas franchise fees. I also can't tell you which cities are imposing which, or even how many of these franchise fees any individual city is imposing. It's just not collected that way. So this is really going to give you kind of the high level. Prior to 1985, there was no data available, even from the state auditor, on franchise fees collected by small cities. Small cities are defined as cities under 2,500 population. However, in 1985, they started collecting it, and at that time, there was only one small city that imposed a franchise fee, and that was the city of Watertown. And it was raising $2,810. By 2014, there's 163 of the small cities that impose franchise fees. However, they are a very small portion of the total. Out of the total, 136.9 million raised, only 2.3 million is raised by these 163 cities. Back in 75, Minneapolis and St. Paul were the vast majority of the franchise fee revenue. They were 86% of the amount that was actually collected. By 2014, their share of the total franchise fees collected in the state had fallen to 44%. And that's because there's just been a large increase in the number of cities that are imposing that. Is this a metro or a non-metro phenomenon? Back in 1975, 8 out of the 23 cities that imposed franchise fees were in the 7-county metropolitan area. There's 101 in the 7-county metropolitan area that now impose it, and 256 in greater Minnesota. Of the cities that imposed it back in 75, they were all tended to be very large cities or regional centers. Now they really range in size. And this just gives you an indication of how the number of cities who impose franchise fees has grown over time. And as I said, this is only a straight count. What it doesn't tell you is if a city that imposed a cable franchise fee for a number of years suddenly added a franchise fee on electric utility. There's no way for me to actually tell that other than by taking a look at how the franchise fee in an individual city has changed over that time period. But this also gives you a sense of how the amount of franchise fees collected in cities has grown. The nominal dollars are are shown in the blue line, and the constant dollars are the dollars adjusted for inflation are in the dotted yellow line. The big change, you see there's a big change between 1974 and 75. That's really because that's when the statutory provision went into effect, and that essentially allowed some of the statutory cities to impose the tax that were not. And then you see some other growth. You may be taking a look at you notice there's kind of an up and down pattern in the 2004 through 2009 period. And that has to do with the fact, as I said, that some franchise fees are taxed on gross receipts, some are taxed on just number of hookups, and a number of cities, as they, you know, as during the recession, their fees were actually falling, so then they were changing their rates, and they were maybe adding other franchise fees. So that's why that period seems a little volatile. And that's really about all I'm going able to tell you about franchise fees, so I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. So one quick question, just to kind of frame it out here. The fact that revenues may be used for general purposes, does the statute say specifically they may use them for general purposes, or is it the absence of any clarifying language that allows them to, or they are interpreting to be allowed for that? You know what I mean? Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I've actually only read the statutes, you know, twice, and so I'm trying to do this by memory. I believe it's an absence of any required dedication, as opposed to, I don't know that it says specifically they may use it for any purpose.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. One, you say it can be by receipts or by hookup. If it's by receipts, would that indicate that someone that has some form of generation wind, you know, solar, who doesn't actually have any receipts, but it, you know, the utility is forced to purchase what they produce, would not have any franchise fee assessed? And then two, if you have instances where a city with a public utility in the city annexes land that goes into a co-op area, how does that affect, is it the co-op versus the public utility, and therefore does that contribute to the you know, co-ops are losing customers to public utilities, and I want to understand if that's an interaction because of franchise fees.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I will first tell you I don't know that I am the qualified person to answer that question. I'm looking to see if our regulated industries person is here. He might be able to better provide information on that.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, Bob Eliff, House Research. Representative Quam, if I understand your question, if a public utility were to annex an area that was previously served by an electric co-op, the gross receipts from those additional customers would be taken into account if the franchise fee were based on gross receipts in paying the fee. So essentially the customers in the co-op would be paying that franchise fee as well.
Thank you. Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton or Mr. Eliff, do taxpayers know, I know we're going to have Representative Vogel's reverse referendum, but do taxpayers know by line item the inclusion of the franchise fee on our billings? I mean, do you know if that's delineated? Because obviously it's passed on to the taxpayers.
Mr. Eliff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, I'm going to look at all
the answers. Does anyone in the House know the answer to that question?
We've
got someone stepping forward, Representative
Super. Thank you.
Erickson.
I mean, as I get my bills, Mr. Chair, I tell you, cable companies increase every month almost. But I haven't looked to see if there's a franchise fee listed, but there are certainly a lot of other fees listed. I just can't believe it.
We've got a very big government, Representative Erickson.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Joel Johnson. I represent the electric co-ops across the state. And it isn't universal. Typically, there will be a single line item on your bill that identifies any franchise fee.
Thank you.
But it's not in every case.
Sure. Thank you.
So, Mr. Johnson, there's no requirements in law saying that if you do a franchise fee, you have to tell the customers what you're charging them. Is that correct, Mr. Johnson?
No, there's nothing in statute that requires that.
Yes.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks. Just a quick one, Mr. Chair. Does a franchise fee grant a monopoly?
Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. Well, for cable TV, the areas are not a monopoly. The statute allows other competitors to enter an area that's already being served. Our electric utilities have service areas that are a monopoly.
So, Mr. Eloff, and maybe Representative Anderson's question is, do franchise fees contribute to becoming a monopoly? Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, franchise fees are more an after-the-fact add-on to the monopolies that, for electric utilities, in essence, are granted by statute. They wouldn't contribute to the formation of monopolies.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay, next on our agenda, Representative Vogel, and he has two presenters and a bill to bring with us, draft bill that he's seeking certainly any feedback that members might have through this discussion and kind of a first run at this issue. Representative Vogel, welcome and thank you for bringing your bill today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to present a draft of the bill. Just a little history. In my business, I tend to read the local newspapers just to watch what's going on. And one of the localities was looking at using franchise fees. I don't think they ended up doing that for a new community center, and it caught my interest. So I decided to investigate what's going on with franchise fees. And as was noted here, there hasn't really been a lot going on with franchise fees. So I came to the conclusion that it would be good to research and see what's going on here, and came to a few key points. First of all, the statute vaguely refers to the use of right-of-way, but then, as was noted before, it's very vague as far as anything else. So these fees can actually just be imposed as the city, the municipality in most cases, because I'm basically addressing gas and electric. The cable has some federal implications that we're really probably be outside of this, but there is a slight reference to right-of-way, but in the statute itself, it really doesn't restrict at all. The public notification rules are also relatively limited. From what I can determine, the municipality can have a public hearing, but may indeed not even need to have one. The utilities are generally not in a position to address the issue. You know, there's always a concern, whether it's a utility or another business, if you're dealing with a local unit of a government, that you really don't want to get maybe on the wrong end of things. So utilities usually aren't going to bring this much to the attention of the ratepayers, because they're going to pass it on anyway, and they really don't want to get into a position of harming themselves if they need future assistance or partnership. My assumption is that the public generally is unaware of what's going on. They may see a franchise fee on their bill, but really don't know what it's doing. So, and the contention would be that it really is in lieu of a tax, because it's going into the general revenue stream of the municipality. Two approaches that I looked at taking. And first one was to restrict the use of franchise fees. And that might be something that could be explored, but due to the largeness of the opening right now of allowing them and then trying to say what is the actual cost of using that right-of-way on an ongoing basis, because I would assume most utilities, when they put in the initial improvement, are already reimbursing the city for any cost of repairing the medians or whatever they're using. So it would have been then in a decision, if we're going to restrict the usage, how would you restrict that usage and come up with a value each year that the city really should be receiving from the utility for the use of an underground, generally, pipe or something? So the other approach was to just provide more transparency. So if we're going to have franchise fees, then let's provide transparency to the taxpayer and really let them decide whether or not they want to impose it. Because I believe in local control, and it would give local control and say, if you want a franchise fee, that's fine. Put it on your electric bill and or gas bill, and it's there for the city. But if not, you also have some recourse, because right now, with the very limited publication and the busyness of everybody's lives to get to a public hearing, if indeed one was to occur, and then maybe sometimes even the limited input that you have is very few citizens showing up, makes it difficult. So what this does is allow the public to be better involved in the process, and eventually to say no if they don't feel that it's a justifiable reason and they would rather see if it has to be an increase on their levy. And then it goes through the other process, which would include truth and taxation hearings. I brought two presenters today to, first of all, you know, it's always difficult when we get into these discussions on is it a fee or is it a tax. But to me, this looks a lot like a tax, and I wanted to bring that to people's attention. And the other thing is, you've heard kind of globally what the amounts are and so forth, but I also got a person from the Metro North Chamber to talk about the impact that this has, because it is significant, and a lot of times more significant probably on employers than it is maybe on residents. But if there's only so much money in a company to go around, and if it's paid in one thing like a franchise tax, it may not be there for an employee. So the bill itself is rather straightforward, even though there tends to be a lot of verbiage. But on page 1, on lines 116, 117, it just adds a line there saying a fee that raises revenue is subject to the requirements in the subdivision 2, which is where all the changes are. And if you go to subdivision 2, it talks about what need to be done. So in other words, beyond what is needed to defray the increased municipal cost, which is probably those costs that are incurred when the initial improvement is made, there has to be a notice that explains the fee, including at a minimum, it raises the revenue for the municipality, the public utility is likely to pass on the fee to the customer, and how much that increase might be, and that the alternative would be to raise the revenue from another source, which would probably be the tax base. Foregoing those or foregoing the planned use of the revenue in the first place. So what it does then is stipulate what has to be done by the city, the municipality, if they want to do this, which would be an official publication, as well as sending a notice to all the affected ratepayers. And that's in there because it may not be that everybody in the municipality is affected by this. You do have areas where you would have, my example in Elko Newmarket, we've got Xcel in the city, but we've got Minnesota Valley Electric that surrounds us, because a lot of the rural area has now become part of the city. So you might have different utilities involved, and not all of them have to be assessed the same franchise fee. So it could be used somewhat discriminatory if it wanted. So this way, every ratepayer that would be affected needs to be notified. And then no sooner than 30 days after the public comment, the municipality can proceed unless a petition is done. So basically, it would be a response that would have to come from the voters, and at least 5% of the voters, if 5% of the registered voters signed a petition subject to the same guidelines of any other petition, then a referendum would be held on the next November election. So it wouldn't necessitate a special election or special election cost. It would preclude the implementation until that election. But and of course, then the voters would get to decide. So basically all it's doing is bringing some transparency to the situation. It is not restricting the use at this point.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. And I think, Representative Vogel, you'd be seeking any input that members might have between now and session. And I've talked to you about this bill, and you're contemplating maybe bringing a jacketed bill in during session for discussion before this committee. So if members have any thoughts, certainly you would entertain those. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel, I'm trying to understand the conflict between Section 1 of your bill and Section 2 of your bill, because Section 1 says a fee that raises revenue. Well, a 1-cent fee raises revenue, so it applies to any, but then in Section 2, you limit it to fees that raise revenue beyond a certain amount. So why the different language in the two parts of the same bill?
Representative Vogel.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, just to help Representative Vogel, I'm looking at, in Subdivision 2, I'm looking at, I think it's 2.16 through 2.18.
Representative Vogel.
Beyond what is needed to defray the increased municipal costs due to the utility operations, the intent there is more or less when they come in to do the work. There would be there may be an ongoing cost. That would have to be very closely defined by them to meet that, of course, because there might be some ongoing cost if you are in the right of way. I don't know what it would be. Maybe if you have power poles, you have to buy a special lawnmower to go cut around them or something. So the key there, again, was not to necessarily restrict the municipality any more than necessary. So by allowing that to be there, what it does is say, obviously, if the municipality is impacted by the right-of-way use in the first place, those costs would be okay to pass on without having to go through the process, as well as if indeed there were ascertainable cost going forward. But it would be a cost-based thing rather than this general notion of being able to use the fee however somebody wanted to use it.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel, I'm still not seeing the conflict. I'm trying to get to the conflict between Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2, because Subdivision 1 uses language in one way, refers to Subdivision 2, but then Subdivision 2 says something else.
I think, Representative Dabney, Ms. Dalton might be able to shed a little light on it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, they aren't really in conflict. Basically, the language in Subdivision 1 says you have to go look in Subdivision 2 and see if you are subject to Subdivision 2. And the language in Subdivision 2 that says this only applies if you are raising more than you actually need to meet the actual costs of the utility operations. Do you have to go through this public hearing and the possible reverse referendum?
So, Mr. Chair, just one last question, but to Ms. Dalton. Is there a consistent statewide standard? Before you say no, but is there a consistent statewide standard on determining the costs? Because the costs, as Representative Vogel have said, if you need to buy a different lawnmower or train staff differently to maintain the property around a power pole or something, that makes sense. But how do you attribute the costs of the staff time in the planning department, the staff time in the public works department, the mayor's and city council's time considering the proposals, how do you attribute under this scenario the incremental costs of the all the publications required and the like that all would fit into implementing this fee? So is there a consistent way that we get to the direct and indirect costs of the franchise, of the utilities work?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, not that I am aware of, but unfortunately Ms. Dyson, our municipal, our local government analyst, could not make it to this hearing today because she's in a bonding hearing, and she may have some more information on that than I have, and I can check into that.
Thank you, Ms. Belton. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and certainly a good point, Representative Dabney, that I see Representative Vogel making notes. So, with that, no other questions, members. We have, at least at this point, Ms. Higgins. Representative Joaquin.
I'm sorry about that. So you're saying a city could go ahead and impose the fee unless it was above and beyond the cost they had to recoup? Or are you saying they have to go out for a referendum? Is it an opt-in or an opt-out? Because it almost sounded like when you presented it, it was the city has to get a referendum passed before they can raise the fee, but then you're saying if it's not past the cost they have, they don't have to do a referendum. So I'm just trying to...
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The city would not necessarily have to be a referendum. What it does is have the city notify those affected by mail, as well as publication, just as if they were doing a new ordinance, so that the people of the city, municipality, are aware that it's going on. Then, if more than 5% said, I want a referendum of the voters, of the registered voters, then the referendum would take place. So it wouldn't preclude the implementation much different than it does now, other than it's a much more public process and bringing transparency to it, because as you can see by what's there now, something like this can be passed relatively easy, and a lot of the people that are affected, maybe most, would never even know what's going on, and they may indeed not even be aware once the fee is being collected.
Representative Joaquin.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Representative Vogel, why did you pick 5%?
Representative Vogel.
It seemed like Mr. Chair and Representative, it seemed to me like a reasonable number that, when you look at 5% of the registered voters, it does sound like somewhat of a small number, but life is busy today. And my sense was that if indeed 5% of the people that are registered voters are willing to go forward and make an extra effort, that it's probably a reason that it could be delayed. Because all this would do then is delay it until the next November election, realistically, because then the voters would all have a chance to speak to it.
And if I could add, I had a bill last session, remember, to move them all to November, and some of them, 10 and 5% were the two common ones in statute and different, mm-hmm. there's a variety of them, so it's fairly consistent with that. Representative Joaquin, anything else?
Yeah, Chair Drazkowski, your bill, House File 1671, actually had 10%, so I was looking at that, wondering. And then one other question, Representative Vogel, have you thought about requesting a local impact note for this? I noticed online... 2.26 first class mail to all affected parties could rack up a pretty hefty price for a city. So I'm just wondering if you thought about talking to the chair about requesting a local impact note.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I did have that discussion, and the criteria, as I understood it, for a local impact statement was different than we typically use here. And so, therefore, at this point, it was my belief that that was not going to be necessary because it didn't. And I'm sorry, I don't have that criteria in front of me, but the criteria that was necessary for a local fiscal impact was significantly different than our House fiscal impact ones that are done.
Okay, other questions, members? Let's hear from Ms. Higgins and Mr. Nelson. Mr. Nelson, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson, and I am a Vice President and Senior Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today to discuss using fees to raise revenue. So part of my job at Center of the American Experiment is to develop policies to improve the administration of government, and one thing that we find very important in that is making government more transparent and more accountable and more outcome-based. And but beyond just researching development, we've also get involved in litigation every once in a while. We never file a lawsuit, but we do file amicus briefs when we think the issue is important to us and to the state of Minnesota. And in one case, last fall, we filed an amicus brief involving the city of St. Paul. The city of St. Paul charges a right-of-way user fee against all of its properties. And through the process of writing that amicus brief and studying that issue, I learned a lot about the distinction between a tax versus a fee and how cities are using fees to raise revenues and how those revenue-raising measures are not real transparent to most of the citizens. So I want to talk a little bit about then this distinction between a tax versus a fee. Now, taxes are the primary tool that governments use to raise revenue. The power to tax is inherent in sovereignty. It's essential to the administration of government, and that's a foundational principle that was laid down back in 1819 by Chief Justice John Marshall. So taxes are here to raise revenue. Despite the fact that taxes are an inherent power in government, it is limited. The state constitution limits taxation in a couple of different ways. First, it requires taxes to be uniform, and second, it requires taxes to go to public purposes. In addition to that, the constitution provides certain exemptions to taxation for churches and nonprofits and other folks. And taxes also must be, if a city is going to provide a special assessment, taxes must that must be administered in a certain way. So that's the basics to taxation. And importantly, I want to really point out importantly that taxation is really the only method which a city can use to raise revenue to fund core services, to fund public purposes. If a city uses some other mechanism to raise taxes to fund public purposes, then they're going to be able to easily subvert these constitutional limitations on taxation, the limitations on uniformity, the exemptions that we see in the Constitution. But nonetheless, that is exactly what an increasing number of cities around Minnesota are starting to do. The city's power to tax is quite clear. Cities are working to diversify their revenue streams by imposing fees and using the fee revenue to fund core services. So in the case of the St. Paul right-of-way fee, they were charging property owners, every property owner in the city, a fee to fund the right-of-way maintenance for the entire city of St. Paul. That included street sweeping, that included snow plowing, that included traffic signals, and the overlay and milling of the streets. And in the process of doing that, the city of St. Paul was able to avoid certain constitutional limitations. One of those was the uniformity limitation, and it resulted in some pretty shocking instances where a church was charged an exorbitant tax, or fee as they called it, and another 27-story tower was charged another fee. Churches were charged $15,000 under this fee, whereas the UBS tower was charged $5,000, basically. This was clearly a problem. And so it goes to this issue of making sure that our constitutional limitations are imposed properly on these fees when they are in fact acting as a tax. I want to quote from the City of St. Paul's right-of-way study to explain what their reason was, because they were actually very explicit. What's interesting about this issue is that cities are very explicit about what they're doing and why they're doing it. So the City of St. Paul said, "The changes in the right-of-way assessment since 2003 were all a result of policymaker wishes to control the growth of property taxes by shifting the responsibility for revenue generation to property owners that benefit from these on-street services." Thus, the idea here behind the fee is to limit the property tax growth, and two, to make more property owners contribute revenue that property owners would otherwise be exempt from contributing. Now, that's the City of St. Paul case, but that is also the explicit rationale put forward to justify franchise fees that we're discussing today. The League of Minnesota City website says franchise fees are often overlooked alternatives for Minnesota cities to diversify the revenue streams. Minneapolis's website says franchise fees are vital to the people of Minneapolis because they help pay for core services. Now, there's, of course, no difference between core services and raising revenue to fund public purposes as it's laid out in the Constitution. Burnsville is in the process of establishing a franchise fee, and they are even more explicit on their intent. Utility franchises, they say on their website, quote, utility franchise fees help cities cover the increasing costs of providing important services without raising property taxes. Now, it didn't take too much digging to find some other examples. I just went to the Excel rate book and looked at all the franchise fees that they've agreed to with cities, and I picked out the two largest fees in that rate book. It happened to be the city of Rogers, and it happened to be the city of Brooklyn Park. When I looked at these cities, and I just Googled these cities and franchise fee, I came up with some headlines in some newspapers. The Star Tribune came up with the headline, Rogers residents protest new franchise fee to cover future road repairs. And a Sun article says, Brooklyn Park City Council supports franchise fees to fix streets. So that's what's going on right now. Clearly, cities are raising these fees to cover core services, to fix their streets, to, as we heard, to build these amusement parks, basically. So there's a number of problems with this. The first problem with all of these fees is that they are going to fund these core services that should otherwise be funded through the tax structure and should be subject to the limitations on taxes. Now, the state statute we discussed earlier does allow cities to raise revenue through franchise fees. And it lays out two specific purposes that you can raise these revenues. It just says you can basically apply the fee to raise revenue and also basically to cover the administration of that franchise fee agreement. Now, because it says to raise revenue, in my mind, that's basically authorizing cities to impose a new type of tax through the franchise fee. And what's kind of confusing and troubling about the way that the statute is laid out is it is basically authorizing this one fee to do two things. And that's, it authorizes it to function as a tax because it's raising revenue to for a public purpose, and it also functions as a regulatory service fee because cities have the power to regulate entities, and they can charge fees to fund that regulation, the administration of that regulation. So it's perfectly appropriate for a city to charge this franchise fee to fund the administration of that without being subject to the limitations of the Constitution. But that's not what's going on here. This franchise fee does both. It functions as a tax, and it functions as a regulatory service fee. And that's become a problem because cities aren't differentiating between that. Cities are actually applying this service fee as a fee, as a regulatory service fee. They're funding core services through that, and it seems to me they're clearly doing it inappropriately. They're charging churches this franchise fee, and it's not entirely clear to me that this fee is being administered uniformly. In some cases it may be, in some cases it may not be, but that's what's happening right now with the service fee. It's become very confusing, I think, for a lot of cities and probably for a lot of residents to understand what's happening, especially in cases like Minneapolis and St. Paul, where we earlier heard, they raise substantial revenue through these fees. I also crunched some numbers, and I found that the city of St. Paul, if they didn't have this franchise fee, if they had to use the revenue, if they had to raise the revenue in some other means, it would result in a 9.6% increase to their property tax levy. And in the city of St. Paul, it was even larger. It was over 16%. So this is a lot of money that is being raised off of these franchise fees to fund core services, and in my opinion, inappropriately and contrary to the Constitution. I don't know how much time I have here, but I've been going on for a little bit, and I can talk a little bit about the problem of transparency, because I think this issue goes to transparent government and giving citizens the tools they need to hold government accountable.
Mr. Nelson, we do have some more speakers,
yep,
too, so let's...
And so let me just close by saying the state statute does allow cities to raise revenue through franchise fees. If they are going to do that, then they need to administer that franchise fee as a tax. and follow all of the constitutional requirements and statutory requirements of a tax, in my opinion. And the Supreme Court has talked about this in the past, despite the fact that the statute calls it a fee. In Country Joe v. City of Eagan back in 1997, the Supreme Court said, we don't care what you call it. If it functions as a revenue-raising measure to fund core public services, we're going to call it a tax. And so I want to leave you with that. And I think when it comes to transparency, I think maybe that issue is going to come up in the next presentation. Thank you,
Mr. Nelson. Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, have we repealed Representative Krinke's a fee as a tax?
Ms. Dalton. Representative Hertas is going to take a stab at it.
No.
maybe not.
Will you check on that, please? Because you and I were here when it was enacted, but it may have been repealed, and we may have missed that.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know it's been proposed to be repealed. I'm just, I cannot remember whether it has actually been repealed or not. I will look.
My recollection is it's still there, Ms. Dalton.
I hope so. I think it might be.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, thanks for an interesting discussion. More and more cities are using fees, as we've discussed, just this last month in three parcels of property that I own in one municipality. I received over $1,200 of new fees, and it's called a stormwater management fee. We use fees for uniform recycling collection, street lighting fees, stormwater management fees, and a myriad of other fees. Are you characterizing service fees as the same as franchise fees?
Mr. Nelson.
So I would call a franchise fee that's appropriately applied a regulatory service fee. And it's the city has the power to regulate that franchise and through its police power. And it has the ability to charge a fee to administer them. Whereas the distinction gets murky is in these issues of a sewage fee and any number of other fees that cities might charge for specific services that kind of I would say that go into the bucket of a commodity fee, whereas the city is kind of administering a program a business might provide. So we've got municipalities that run their electric utilities, and so they can charge for that, obviously. That's not a tax. That's a commodity fee, basically. And so your stormwater fees and those and sewage fees, that's a service that the city's providing to residents. And they're getting a benefit from that, a clear benefit from that, a direct benefit from that. And it's a direct benefit that's based on their usage. Your sewage fee is based on how much sewage you produce. And your water fee is based on how much water you use. So those are, and so court, we don't really care too much about paying too close attention to those because they are things that are very much tied to the usage. Whereas in this case, in this regulatory service fee case, where franchise fees are being used to fund core services, we're no longer talking about an issue where the fee is used to provide, to administer the service, it's being used to just raise general revenue.
Representative Hertas?
Well, yeah, just a follow-up in your issue about uniformity in the case that I mentioned with regards to the stormwater management fee. You know, rain falls on the land and uniformly runs off of it in somewhat of a similar fashion, paved exceptions over non-paved. But I found that there was really nothing uniform about a commercial piece of property that's undeveloped paying $800 for 3 acres and then a 40-acre parcel paying $100 because it's farmland and a residence paying $50. So, I mean, there's nothing uniform about that.
Excuse me.
Mr. Nelson.
Chair, Representative Pertak. The Constitution does allow you to vary the uniformity based on the class of the property. Yeah. So that is appropriate. But you have picked probably the murkiest fee out there to very variously define how it works. The stormwater runoff, it happens.
Especially when this community does not have any storm sewer. So.
Yeah, it happens, and it's a direct.
So, Mr. Nelson, we got to keep going here. I'm going to ask staff, Ms. Dalton, if someone would put together a list of all these fees that we have for local governments and maybe categorize them somehow, or Mr. Nelson, maybe you want to help with that project, but it seems there's a lot of them. Ms. Higgins, welcome.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lori Higgins, and I'm the president of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce, which represents 700 businesses in the North Metro Anoka County area. The Metro North Chamber has long opposed franchise fees, and I'm here to give a few remarks as to why in context to the legislation before you today. First and foremost, franchise fees are not a transparent form of government. Presently, franchise fees are required to be collected by the respective utility company, not the specific unit of government who is using these fees. And as practiced, taxpayers are literally in the dark as to who is collecting this money and for why. Regarding that, there's little transparency as to for what purpose the franchise fee is being used. While a city may begin the process of establishing franchise fees over the need to fix a road or some other project, once initiated, the collected monies easily become an expected part of the city's revenue stream to be used in all perpetuity. In fact, a business owner recently told me that in his discussion with a city official, it was remarked that the city would have to cut staff if the franchise fee were eliminated. This is ironic, considering that that employer pays the city $40,000 a year in franchise fees that the employer himself could have used to grow his business instead of government hiring another employee, which further helps the local economy. Finally, on the issue of transparency, there is very rarely widely shared information to residents and businesses when the franchise fee issue is under consideration by the cities. Already twice in the past year, I have received notice at the last minute that a franchise fee issue was scheduled on a council meeting agenda for testimony, only to have the issue be too far down the road for remarks to make any difference whatsoever in the eyes of those policymakers. Requiring legislation mandating greater communication by the municipalities to allow taxpayers a better chance to provide feedback much earlier in the process is not only common sense, but it also benefits the greater good for the valuable relationship between the city and its stakeholders. Additionally, providing an opportunity for a citizen-led referendum on establishing a new fee so it goes before all voters also fits as an inherent part of the democratic process. So why does the Chamber of Commerce get so involved in this issue? Besides the critical concern of governmental transparency, these franchise fees negatively impact job growth and business expansion, especially amongst high energy users and specifically large commercial and industrial companies. These employers pay market-driven wages and benefits in the communities where they reside and are the very engine of the American economy. Without growth and expansion, this in turn hurts the city from economic development consideration. As an example, the city of Coon Rapids charges 4% of their utility bill for the city-required franchise fee. This 4% collectively aggregates into a substantial amount for employers. To put that into dollars, large manufacturers pay $20,000, $40,000, even $60,000 a year just in this one franchise fee mandate alone. That is revenue off of their bottom line that they must find ways to offset through either more sales or less expenses that can and will affect their decisions to expand. $40,000 and $60,000 in franchise fees are certainly the equivalents of decent paying jobs. And a locally required franchise fee is definitely something that a business looking to relocate will take into consideration. With that, my colleague at the White Bear Chamber of Commerce, Tom Snell, who has worked on this issue for decades, he could not be here today, but he asked me to share one paragraph with you. On behalf of the White Bear Area Chamber of Commerce, I express support for this proposed legislation that enacts changes in franchise fee regulations. The White Bear Area Chamber of Commerce has a membership of approximately 400 businesses. There definitely needs to be more transparency when local elected officials pursue a franchise fee. Frequently, the decision-making process in enacting a franchise fee is cloaked in secrecy until right before a council vote. Unfortunately, by that time in the process, it has gone too far to be reversed. Additionally, once a franchise fee is put into place, it seems to go on autopilot. It is practically impossible to find a community that has adopted a franchise fee and then eliminates it. The citizens of local communities need an easier process to organize so the voters can decide the fate of their franchise fee. In my opinion, the current process for overturning a franchise fee is extremely daunting. I could give you a host of reasons why franchise fees are also both regressive and bad tax policy. However, a good first step would be to require greater openness by city officials considering a franchise fee. On behalf of Tom and myself, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Vogel, I am glad you bring this bill forward. I think it presents a couple of real core issues and core questions we should be asking ourselves. One of those is certainly around transparency, and Mr. Nelson, I completely agree with you. Call it a fee or a tax. If it walks like a duck, sounds like a duck, it's coming from our pockets, and we have to pay for that. So, you know, but I think this bill maybe, I don't know, convolutes the process a little bit. I think maybe adds a little more to what we could be doing. I think it adds more process, possibly more cost to local governments, which could result in growing local governments, actually. A second point I'd like to talk about is, you know, if we see this largely as a money grab by local governments, I think we also have to acknowledge that local governments have to continue to operate. They have to continue to function. We have to plow roads, we have to repair potholes, and we have to make sure that first responders are happy and well compensated. And so there are other ways that we can do this. We can be discussing local government aid. We can be discussing county program aid, township aid we can be discussing. And also, I think it sounds to me, based on Representative Erickson's cable bill, that some franchise fees we could be really looking at are those imposed by the private sector that don't even show up in our bills, that we don't even know what those fees are. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Another questions for Ms. Higgins or Mr. Nelson, members? Thank you both. Next, members, I have to apologize because kind of our standing approach for this committee is to have regular people go first before lobbyists and people who work in government, and I have to apologize to Ms. Weir in the first part. We should have, we're getting the cobwebs out, members, so we'll be back on track when we get into session. So what we're going to do is have Mr. Bradley and Mr. DeBoer come up here and rearrange our agenda to reemphasize that focus on providing direct access to this committee by real people. And I don't know, Representative Bradley, I guess you're kind of in the real people category now. Thank you both for coming today. And Representative Fran Bradley, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members and staff. Let me first of all thank you for your service. Having been here, I know the sacrifices that you make, and I, regardless of what you came from, I appreciate so much that you serve. Mr. Chair, I'm also mindful of the top of the clock. And
Mr. Representative Bradley, we can go over. I think members will stick around as long as they can hold off the lunch desire.
With that, Mr. Chair, we will try to accelerate as best we can.
Thank you.
For those that may have sensed it from the introduction, I had the honor of having served in this body a bit ago, but that was a different time. Today I am really before you as a citizen of Rochester. My name is Fran Bradley. We're here really because we bumped into something. We bumped into a proposal for our city to impose a natural gas franchise fee. We took a look at the statute, and the statute said something about recovering recurring costs. And we thought, oh, okay, let's check that. Well, we were told there are no costs. It's just adding more fees, which you may see here by our button. Really, we felt like, you know what, let's understand a little bit more about the phenomenon that we call stealth taxes. You're a property tax division. We all know that there's considerable attention to property taxes, as there should be. There's also transparency and accountability. I mean, the publicity everywhere, the hearings. However, when you begin to get under it, as the Central American Experiment pointed out, what you find out is there's a whole nother avenue of revenue coming in that we would characterize as stealth taxes. And those come in the way of fees of all types. They come in the way of in lieu of taxes. They come in the way of franchise fees. And by the way, as a collection, if you look at the local taxes for Rochester, the total of those user and other fees is 25%. Of the local amount. So it isn't insignificant anymore. It's become very significant. It isn't just a little thing on the side. The other ingredient that we found, as I said, when we looked at this particular proposal, was that there was really no basis of recovery of cost. It was clear and simple additional tax. Good story. In the end, the City Council saw the wisdom of our advocacy, and it did not pass, at least not now. but it's not going away. So on a larger scale, we're here really to kind of give you a local experience and then to also share with you some of the other kinds of forms of franchise fees and other fees. And in fact, I mean, there's different ways, but we in fact even have some suggestions on possible language. It's very confusing to read this mention of recurring costs, but then the other part of the phrase says to raise revenue. Well, why do you even need to mention the recurring costs if it's just simply going to be raise revenue and put it into general funds? So it looks to me like you're on the right track, Mr. Chair and members, to really take a hard look at this field. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the real brains of this operation. Mr. DeBoer is the person who really does some terrific analysis, and we'll try to move it along quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brather. Mr. DeBoer.
Chairman Druskowski, members of the Property Tax Committee, my name is Thomas DeBoer. I live at 626 15th Street, Northeast in Rochester, Minnesota. I sincerely thank you for the opportunity to address you today. What I'm going to be sharing with you is the presentation that I gave to the Rochester City Council back in January of 2015. It had a few slides. I believe you'll have a handout of those. I'm not going to go through all of those. In the essence of time, I'm going to pick out some key points here for you to look at, so I'm going to jump through these fairly quickly. Let me go back to one slide here. What we're here to do today is really talk about current statute 216B36, and really it's a sentence that is in about the center of that, and really, again, it's municipal fees to raise revenue or defray increased municipal costs accruing as a result of utility operations. That's what the driver of this for the utilities fees are. I'm going to jump ahead here to get to a different slide. This slide here, basically, the current law in Rochester says the utility company has to pay for all costs for any work they do in right of way. The city is not responsible whatsoever. Okay? Next one that's important here is we brought this forward and we said, well, what are your costs? I sent an email to the Public Works Director and his response was, so there are no direct costs associated with the presence, inconvenience, relocation, or lost contractor productivity attributable to private utilities located in the public right-of-way that we budget or can even point to in the bid abstract of a project. So when we asked the hard question, they couldn't justify it. It truly, in this case, was to bring in general revenue for the city's budget. One thing I would like to point out is that utility lines in underground cases are generally only 24 to 30 inches deep, the phone lines, the gas lines, and the cable lines. So it is not that hard when work takes place by a city in a public right-of-way to identify where those lines are and find them. Our go-for-one-call thing works very well. My background is in utility business for 40 years, so I've been involved in this. That system works very well. So when you're doing an excavation, you know almost nowadays to the inch where you're going to find that pipe. So there isn't a whole lot of lost time when you try to find a line that you have to work around. Let me get to slide 9 here. One thing on this slide that's very important, I'm going to look at the center bullet. The taxes currently paid to the city by Minnesota Energy were in excess of $750,000 a year. That will be collected from the city, plus the new proposed franchise fee. These taxes are collected in customer gas rates. Therefore, the citizens of Rochester are already being taxed for underground piping and also for city sales taxes as part of their monthly payments to Minnesota Energy. Again, this $2 fee that they were going to add to our natural gas bill every month was all the costs the city incurred by having that utility in public right-of-way were already covered in this $750,000 of taxes paid to the city by Minnesota Energy. One more. Okay, in Rochester we have several fees that we pay to the city of Rochester in the form of either in lieu of tax payments, and I'm just going to zip through these. As a typical utility customer, I pay $51.55 to the city of Rochester for electric use in my home. That is a local government electric utility that pays money in amounts of about $11 million a year to the city, to their general fund, and I'll have a summary of this. I also pay $9.64 a year for in lieu of water tax. I pay $74.16 a year for the stormwater fee. I pay $14.16 a year in the residential fire hydrant fee. I pay $6.36 for the Minnesota groundwater fee. And I pay $50.52 for the charter franchise fee, for a total of $206 a year that are added in fees to my expenses paid to the city of Rochester. And again, we were looking at a $2 a month gas franchise fees. It would have been went up by $12. Our concern with this is that when you pay these fees, you cannot deduct those fees on your income taxes. So I showed the council, if I was in the 22% tax bracket, based on that $206, I would save $45 a year on taxes. If I was in the 32%, I'd save $66 a year. If I was in the 42% tax bracket, I'd save $87 a year by having those costs on my property taxes rather than pay them in these fees. Next slides, I'm just going to summarize. An average home in Rochester has a market value of $177,000. They're going to pay $2,177 a year in property taxes. The city portion of those taxes are $766, or 35.2%. The fees, if the fees were added instead of and put on our taxes, that would go to $972 a year. My city portion of the taxes would then rise to 40.8% of my tax bill. That's one of the reasons the cities like to do this, is they don't want to see their portion of the taxes on your tax bill be higher than the county or higher than the school district. Well, in the case of Rochester, there's where we would be on an average priced home. Again, my property taxes would have risen to $2,383 a year. Here's what's really interesting, and another reason why the cities like to do this. When our city administrator gives us our overview of the city budget for the year, he always proudly displays this slide. Rochester happens to rank number 4 on their property tax rate, and what that is, if you take your property value of a home in thousands of dollars and multiply it by the $49.17, that's how much I would pay on my taxes. That shows Rochester's rate at $49.17, and we're number 4 in the state. But interestingly, if we added in that $206 of fees, we would rise to number 2 in the state, and we would go to $62.47. So it does distort what it costs you to live in Rochester on a tax basis by having all of these fees. And here's the money that comes into the city of Rochester on an annual basis. They're basically bringing in $71.6 million a year in the form of funds from taxpayers and people that live there. Of that, $53.4 million comes from property tax, direct property tax payments. And as Mr. Bradley pointed out, 25.5%, or $18.237 million, comes in all these fees. And then what I've summarized is these fees by section down below. And in this case, I did add that $350,000 of the franchise fee from People's Natural Gas or Minnesota Energy, if that would have been placed on there. So this is a significant amount of revenue that really, as a citizen, once these fees are in place, they're hidden. You really don't have a way to go out and change those. They're there forever. Interestingly, my life in Rochester goes back over 40 years. I battled way back in the early 1980s on the in lieu of tax for the electric customers in Rochester, and I pushed real hard, and I was at a council hearing one night, and they finally got upset with me for bringing this up, and one of the council members looked to me, and his exact words, and I remember them very vividly, So what if we want to use our utility as our rich uncle? That was the attitude. And that fee has continued to rise each year. In Rochester, you pay about 6/10 of a cent for every kilowatt hour of energy you use, whether it's commercial or residential or industrial. And that's why that amount is almost $11.5 million a year. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Bradley for closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. DeBoer. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's the high-speed version. I hope you kind of got, though, the gist. I mean, the gist is fairly straightforward. We could probably challenge a little bit about tracking the expenditures by local governments, which even the property taxes, with all of the attempts to buy them down and so forth, have still increased substantially, at least in our case, above the index or the inflation rates. In spite of that, of course, that apparently is not enough revenue, so these other forms. And what we just simply ask, really, from this committee's point of view, I know your focus can be largely, I'm happy to see, though, you're recognizing that the taxpayers in our local community do pay more than just their property taxes. You know, there's no question about it, really, and if you choose the franchise fees, in the end, it is the households that pay those fees, however it gets passed through. Transparency might help. Our feeling, frankly, is that we ought to adhere in that case and even to other user fees to being able to connect them directly to the costs or to the benefit to the user and get out of the business of allowing these things to be used for just sort of a general fund collection. There simply isn't the transparency, there isn't the accountability, and as Tom pointed out, there isn't even the fundamental tax benefit of being able to deduct those kinds of things as you can typically your real estate taxes. With that, Mr. Chair, we do thank you so much for this opportunity. Continue the good fight. We wish you the best. Good luck.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Question for you from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, listening to this and the points, it appears as if these franchise fees are a very regressive and more highly impact the poor and the people on fixed income. And I'm just surprised that many of the stakeholders that jump on regressive taxes haven't joined in. Is it just because of the lack of transparency or communication of this impact on the poor and fixed income?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, you know, I learned in the legislature to be careful about trying to judge other people's motives, and I'll probably apply that as well to the cities, and only really talk about the consequences. You bring up something that's sort of interesting, by the way. In the real estate taxes, for trying to account for people's ability to pay, we have systems. We have a system that allows you to get rebates based on your income. There is no way to accommodate that if it's a franchise fee or all the other fees. So, in fact, what you're pointing out is, in a sense, another fairness that there really is no. I don't think that I have what's the index of the regressivity of those, but it's pretty intuitive that since it doesn't have any of those breaker kinds of things, that it is regressive.
Other questions, members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a request as we continue to research this and dig into the bill, perhaps we could get a count balance for those stormwater fees, you know, especially, you know, cities are building a reserve for any, you know, cases of emergency or maintenance. So if there's a way that we can also get what some of the cities, not only the fees, but the accounts on a stormwater fee.
Okay. Ms. Dalton, can anything you can do to put some of that together? There's a fire hydrant fee. I wonder what the dog has to say about that.
The dog should pay for it, Mr. Chair.
And there's a right-of-way fee and others. So, Ms. Dalton, whatever you can do to kind of address Representative McDonald's question, or maybe someone else. I don't know who the right people are to ask that.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I will certainly work with the League of Minnesota Cities to see what information they have. I do know that there is some breakdown on fees and charges within the state auditor reports, but they're fairly limited. To the extent that there are some there, I will try to provide the committee with those that information.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I think it would be helpful to at least have a list to start with because, I mean, we're kind of unearthing some things that maybe many of us were not aware of. Other questions? Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just to add that, I guess as a former mayor, I should know what was in our account, but I think we who are interested in this, our lawmakers, can call our local cities in our districts. I think I'm going to do that now and just find out as well so it's not all your work, Ms. Dalton, that we can do some of the legwork as well. So,
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Druskowski. Just a caution on looking at those stormwater fees. Every city uses them differently. In Hopkins, as in about 50% of the cities out there, they use that stormwater to defray when they do a total reconstruct on a city. They're using those stormwater fees to pay for the utilities underneath so folks don't have to get assessed for it. So then there's another half of the cities that actually assess everybody for the entire project. So when you're looking at those fees, you really looking at what they have in their bank account, you really have to think about all those different aspects.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Thank you both for coming from Rochester today, and appreciate your testimony, and thanks for your handouts as well. You had some ideas, members. There's a couple ideas that Mr. DeBoer handed out here on some potential language maybe you want to take a look at as we go forward with this issue. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And lastly on the agenda, we have Mr. Carlson and Mr. Neal. Oh, and then an individual from Elk River, and I didn't catch their name, but I think we will now. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and respond. Let me start out by saying that I think Ms. Dalton did a very good job of outlining the franchise fee collections and the history of that. I'm going to turn that off. And I think given the substance of this bill and many of the comments about transparency and accountability, I think I'd just like to quickly move into the testimony of two city presenters here. The City of Edina, Scott Neal, City Manager, is here, and Justin Femright with the City of Elk River is here. He showed up. I didn't know he was going to be here, so I apologize for not having his name on the list. But I'd like to have them share with you their actual experiences, how they implemented these fees, how they involved the public, and what they used the money for. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Neal, please introduce yourself and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Neal. I'm the city manager in Edina. And my story about franchise fees really starts with another topic, and that is how city council members, elected officials at the local level, are trying to be responsive to citizens. In 2011, our council began to get more and more requests and demands, in some sense, from our residents for sidewalks and trails in the community. They'd been getting those requests for many years, but it had kind of reached a point where they were deciding, how do we respond to these? Because every time we want to build a sidewalk, people want the sidewalk, but they don't want to pay for the sidewalk. And that was a conundrum that they were reaching, you know, year after year after year. At that point, we began to discuss what are the alternatives. What can we do to fund sidewalks that are outside the special assessment process? We looked at lots of different options, and through a public discussion at council meetings and work sessions in early spring of 2012, our council began the serious discussion about a franchise fee. We, up until this point, the only franchise fee in our city was a cable television franchise fee, which is pretty common from city to city. It's a 5% on gross sales of cable bills, and that's regulated at the federal level. We continued to work through that process. In 2012, we got a direction from our council to meet with our local utilities, both Xcel Energy and CenterPoint Energy, to figure out how to put a new franchise fee in place. The utilities, it's important to have a dialogue with the utilities because they're concerned about internal equity among their customers, their various classes of customers, and they're also concerned about equity between energy sources, so between gas and electric. So we had an extensive dialogue with both of our local utilities, and finally put together a proposal that was adopted on first reading, an ordinance, because utility franchise fees are established by ordinance, in the fall, I think it was September of 2012. There's a 60-day waiting period between when you adopt it on first reading and when you adopt it on second reading. So that gives time for the utility to notify customers and to notify the PUC that something is that a utility fee is being contemplated. We adopted. We had a public hearing. We adopted the ordinance on second reading in December. It went into effect on January 1st. Utilities are required to disperse franchise fees on a quarterly basis. So franchise fees for the first period at which they were charged in Edina, January, February, of March of 2013, were paid sometime at the end of April. In our case, in 2013, that amounted to around $800,000, and it means in 2014 and 15, around $1 million a year. In our case, our council, by policy, dedicated all of that money towards pedestrian and cyclist safety projects. So we have a special fund where it's allocated, so 100% of the money is transparently traced from when it's received by the city into our PACS fund, our pedestrian and cyclist safety fund. It's used for projects. About 80% of it every year is spent on capital projects, so improvements in the community, and 20% of it is spent on staff and maintenance kind of costs. We included one full-time employee as part of this program to coordinate sidewalks, and we were able to build about 10,000 linear feet of sidewalks a year with this revenue source. It's highly treasured by our council because it allows them to fulfill a citizen request and need without having to issue a property tax or without having to increase our property tax levy. It's also of interest that our council thought one of the reasons they liked the franchise fee is because it was transparent. When you receive a monthly utility bill, it's very clearly on the monthly utility bill, city franchise fee, colon, and then the amount. In our case, the amount was $1.45 per month per household. There's a range of fees depending on the kind of meter involved. So business customers or larger demand customers, energy customers, pay a higher fee, but it's a fixed fee. Most of our customers in Edina are residential customers. Well over 90% paid that dollar 45, both on the electric side and the gas side. The largest franchise fee is $40 per meter, and those are for just a couple of large customers in our community. So that was something they liked. The other part of it that they liked that we've discussed a little bit here at this hearing today is that while it is easy to turn on a utility franchise fee ordinance, it's pretty easy to turn it off. If a city doesn't want it anymore, there isn't in current law any requirement to do referendums or reverse referendums. You just repeal the ordinance, and a council in Edina could do that pretty easily. You could do it with 3 out of 5 members voting to repeal it at any time. So those are a couple attributes of the user fee or the franchise fee ordinance that my council thought were important. In fact, in last year, they increased our franchise fee by 50 cents to create a sustainability conservation and sustainability function in our city government to create more money to provide for conservation and sustainability related capital improvements in the city. So improvements to our lighting systems and water conservation systems and things like that. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Let's go to Mr. Vemright, and then we can maybe take questions for both of you collectively. Mr. Vemright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Femright. I currently am the city engineer for the city of Elk River. In 2012, the city council began discussions around revenue sources to support our ever-increasing costs of pavement management within the city, looking at our existing revenue sources through bonding, property taxes, as well as special assessments, and evaluated the program moving forward. We were a community that grew rapidly in the 90s. Those streets all coming of age needing specific maintenance, and how appropriate were our existing funding sources for providing that maintenance. Through discussions, through the work sessions that we held with the council, they steered staff towards the idea of
charging the franchise fee and collecting revenues through the franchise fee in lieu of the existing source of property taxes and in lieu of special assessments. So our program moving forward is funded with revenues collected from our franchise fee. Property owners are not faced with $6,000, $10,000 special assessments when we come through to do a pavement management program. It keeps our management program on track and on schedule so we can do the right maintenance at the right time, most economically for our system and our residents to maintain that surface, no longer subjecting it to the emotions of a public hearing process as it relates to special assessment hearings and people's ability and in many cases very vocal about their inability to pay for special assessments and what that does to them in their own circumstances. So we've heard a lot of testimony today about success stories from different communities and how franchise fees and the process that exists now works for other communities. Our success story in Elk River is, you know, selecting it as an option and a program moving forward that really works for us. And there's been a lot of discussion about transparency and looking at some of the draft language. I would say from a transparency standpoint, we met or exceeded many of the points for public mailings, public notice, and things like that in implementing this, because ultimately those residents that see it on their bill and it says City of Elk River franchise fee, in fact the first year's worth of bills on that same line said call the city with my particular phone number, and I'd receive calls, you know, to explain what that dedicated revenue source is coming in and what that's doing for them. It is a dedicated revenue source that's collected on a per account basis, but you know, the success that we had and the transparency that we had before implementing that franchise fee as the preferred source has attributed to the success and the acceptance of the community and the acceptance of not only our residents, our businesses, and you know, we've had a lot of positive support behind it. And you know, I could go on for an hour if anybody wants to talk about the intricate details.
We don't have an hour, Mr. Fenwright.
Mr. Chair, I won't go on for an hour. But again, being involved from the beginning scoping of it all the way through implementation and seeing all of the pieces, and again, how it's been successful in our case, it's been a great tool.
Thank you. Quick question, then Representative Erickson's got a question. But so once it's dedicated, using your word, Mr. Fenwright, is there anything precluding a city from changing from dedicated to suddenly, well, today we want to use this revenue for something else? Is there specificity in your ordinance that self-limits you, or can you tell us about that? Mr. Fenwright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is it is specified in the fee ordinance specifically that it is that it goes to our pavement management fund and is used for only pavement management projects. That does not preclude future councils from amending that ordinance or changing that ordinance if they were to elect to do that. But again, it's at the local control on our existing ordinance. That's where it's dedicated.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Sir, just tell us, how much did you collect in the first year?
Mr. Femmer?
Are you able to share that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, our fee was set to, you know, meet the needs of our pavement management program. We worked that out 60 years. We came back to what do we need to collect on an annual basis between our electric and gas franchise fees that we put in place, we're collecting about $1.4 million annually.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And then what have you dispersed so far?
Mr. Femmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, we complete large maintenance projects on an every other year basis, and at this time, we're spending, you know, every other year in that $2.8 to $3 million range. $1.4 million per year doesn't quite get us there. We use some of our state aid funding from our municipal state aid account to make up that balance. But we're not, and the point I'm trying to make is we're not growing a balance of a fund. We're not increasing and not creating this large pot. We're using it. We're using that as we go.
Other questions, members? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Neal and Mr. Femright.
Thank you.
Anyone else who would like to testify about this topic or have anything to add to the discussion today? It's been long, and we dug into an area that many of us hadn't seen or heard a lot about before. But members, thank you for coming today. I'd like to introduce Mr. Bartle, who will be our committee legislative assistant. And so he's new. Let's welcome him here today. I guess we are. And if you have any questions, things you would like to bring to the attention of the chair or the committee, feel free to contact him. His door is open. Actually, he doesn't have a door. So thank you. With that, members, meeting's adjourned.